Today is Thursday, August 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Beirut continues sifting through the rubble of a catastrophic explosion.
We stand ready to assist the government of Lebanon, and it's as it grapples with this horrible tragedy. You'll see the United States announce a number of things we intend to do to assist the people of Lebanon in the coming days.
As the pandemic rages in the U.S., the debate over opening schools continues. Also ahead, Lady Gaga is branching out with a new show on Apple Music. It's all on today's International Edition. Lebanese rescue teams Wednesday pulled out bodies and hunted for more who are missing in the wreckage of buildings as investigators blamed negligence for a massive warehouse explosion that sent a devastating blast wave across Beirut, killing at least 135 people. More than 5,000 others have been injured from Tuesday's explosion at Beirut port, and up to 250,000 were left without homes fit to live in after shockwaves smashed building facades, sucked furniture out onto streets, and shattered windows miles inland. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has the latest.
Lebanon officials have acted quickly in detaining workers in a probe into Tuesday's devastating explosion. The Lebanese government says it's putting an unspecified number of Beirut port officials under house arrest, pending an investigation into how 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate came to be stored at the port for years. The move comes amid speculation that negligence was to blame for the explosion that killed more than 100 people. The move was announced following a cabinet meeting during which the government declared a two-week state of emergency, effectively giving the military full powers during this time. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Lebanon is not normally known as a place where terrible safety violations occur, so Tuesday's massive explosion in Beirut's strategic port has many questioning why large quantities of a lethal chemical would be stored unsafely for 6 years in the center of the capital and so close to homes, businesses, and a major highway. As Dale Gavlak reports from Amman, Lebanon's prime minister declared Wednesday a day of mourning and promised that those responsible would pay the price.
The Lebanese are reeling after the massive port explosion causing injury, death, and destruction, saying that for many it is the last straw. They say they are fed up with the country's politicians who have been running and ruining the country for the past 30 years. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University tells VOA that he and his family fled to their basement when they heard the terrifying explosion 7 kilometers away, just as they used to during Lebanon's deadly 1975-1990 civil war.
This is a disaster. It's yet another sign of the rotten, decrepit situation in which we find ourselves. It's a puppet government, and those who are pulling the strings have zero interest in reforms.
President Michel Aoun blamed the powerful blast on 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate, saying it was unacceptable that the lethal chemical was stored in a port warehouse for 6 years without safety measures. Experts like Anthony May, a retired explosives investigator with the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, told CNN that only 2 tons of ammonium nitrate caused the huge devastation in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. He and other foreign security experts say, however, the massive pinkish-orange smoke plume seen from the explosion suggests that military explosives were also present, and may question why the materials were stored in such a vulnerable but highly important site. Mohamed Haj Ali of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut tells VOA the blame for this incident lies squarely at the government's feet.
This massive failure in protecting people, which is the basic tenet of any governance, they failed at it, and they failed drastically. For many Lebanese, this was a kind of an event that encapsulated all the failures, the current system of governance, and those at the helm of government, ruling elite, basically, since the 1990s. This is a catastrophe which is man-made, and it's caused by a bunch of officials which know accountability. There's an inherent problem in the system, and this has become clear to the people of Lebanon more and more after this event.
Lebanon's powerful Catholic Cardinal Bashar Arai has called on the international community to come to Lebanon's aid without strings attached. But Hajj Ali says that may be difficult for countries already struggling from the dire economic effects of the coronavirus pandemic. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
A new Associated Press poll finds U.S. testing for the coronavirus is dropping as infections remain high and the death toll rises by more than 1,000 a day. Officials attribute the trend largely to Americans getting discouraged over having to wait days or weeks for results. In a Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health online forum, Dr. Anthony Fauci says in past national crises like 9/11, the nation has pulled together, but this time people are pulling apart.
Now, there's such a divergence of how people view this and such a divisiveness that has now crept into the political. Remember, a little while ago, you know, it depends on whether you wear a mask on how you feel politically, which was completely ridiculous.
Widespread testing is considered essential to managing the outbreak as the U.S. approaches 5 million confirmed infections and more than 157,000 deaths out of over 700,000 worldwide. Meanwhile, President Trump continues to push for all schools in America to reopen, even stating on Fox News that children are almost immune to getting the virus.
Children are almost, and I would almost say definitely, but almost immune from this disease. So few, they've got stronger, hard to believe, I don't know how you feel about it, but they have much stronger immune systems than we do somehow for this, and they do it, they don't have a problem. They just don't have a problem.
The comments come as it was reported that a child in Georgia tested positive after his first day back to school. Joining us to talk more about it is infectious disease specialist, epidemiologist, Dr. Ravina Kular.
What do you think we need to do to keep kids safe, and obviously not just kids, but who they're bringing this virus home to potentially?
I'm very concerned right now with schools opening in some states. And I think, you know, what we saw in the beginning is that preliminary studies showed in the early months of the pandemic, they suggested that children were not significant carriers of coronavirus. But now we've seen that that's just not true. And now that we know that, I am very concerned that these schools are opening. And you see an outbreak that happened in a June sleepover camp in Georgia with at least 260 children and adults contracted COVID-19. You see a school that just opened in Georgia. It's making substantial press. It's just seeing that picture of all these jam-packed kids in a hallway and just makes you really concerned, not only for the children, as you stated before, their family members as well. And in my opinion, it's too early to open up schools right now. I think the school system have to invest in virtual learning to really still embrace learning and teaching to the students and not putting them and their family at risk.
Obviously, with 1,000 deaths a day continuing, we are approaching about 5 million infections across the United States. Clearly, this pandemic is here. Do you feel like we're in it for a long time now at this point? Is it out of control?
I think we are. I think it's really sad to see just things funneling down and down. I mean, the latest daily caseload is about 10,000 more than the prior day's increase. I mean, that's concerning. And I think it's definitely a way to contain this is not opening schools. I think that's going to cause more damage than anything. I think we need to really sit down and figure out how we can contain this outbreak, or else things are going to get even worse.
And what about a vaccine? We've been hearing a lot recently from the president and some pharmaceutical companies that are in trial that we could see a vaccine by the end of this year. I've heard other medical experts saying that's not really realistic. Is that possible?
These vaccines are undergoing a very unique trial design where it's called Operation Warp Speed, where, you know, they have set this ambitious goal of delivering about 300 million doses of vaccine that's safe, effective by January. You know, it takes lengthy studies to really be conducted to really determine the safety and the efficacy. And right now, I'm on the fence of really if that's possible, if it's really, if there's going to be enough robust studies that will be conducted to really make the public confident in the effectiveness and, most importantly, the safetyness of these vaccines. We have 27 vaccines are in clinical trials. I would say some of the ones which have made the biggest leap is Moderna, They just started their phase 3 clinical trial at the end of July, and they have reported that they plan to enroll at about 30,000 patients and should hopefully get, maybe if all goes well, the vaccine available by early next year, end of this year. You know, 30,000 patients in my mind is not enough people that you need to determine safety and efficacy, but we are in a pandemic here.
Do you have any concerns that this is a push to get a vaccine that may or may not be safe because of the fact that we have, it's an election year and it's political?
It might be. I think what we've seen in general in this pandemic, where it should be a health issue, it's become very politicized. And I really hope I wish it wasn't that case, but I think the evidence is stronger and stronger that it is becoming very politicized, and that's harming people, as can clearly be seen.
Infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist Dr. Ravina Kular.
Texas, the second largest state in the U.S., continues to fight new cases of COVID-19. One rural county called Star at the Texas-Mexico border has been facing challenges that are different from those of more urban areas. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details.
While many stores in the U.S. are desperately trying to stay afloat during the pandemic, Veronica Gonzalez's small business is booming, but she does not see it as a blessing.
It's already 7 p.m. and we've got funeral sprays to deliver tomorrow, and it's been increasing in our business, unfortunately.
Gonzalez lives in the Texas border town of Roma, with a population of less than 12,000.
We're bordering Miguel Alemán. It's Mexico. Yeah. It's about 3 blocks from here.
Roma and surrounding communities in Starr County have been hit hard by the coronavirus, but the reality here is different from that in many other Texas counties. Starr, one of the poorest counties in Texas, has a Latino majority. Often out of necessity, large families live together. The area also has one of the highest rates of diabetes and obesity in the state, so anyone who contracts COVID-19 is at high risk of complications. During the first 2 months of the U.S. lockdown, Starr County barely saw any cases, says Dr. Jose Vasquez, the county's health authority.
On a daily basis, we had 1, 2, 3 cases. It was a period of time from mid-April to May where we went for 21 straight days without any single positive case in Starr County.
We had kept it very cool for the first couple of months. I think it just exploded.
Then at the end of April, Texas started reopening its businesses. That, followed by 2 holidays and Father's Day, caused a surge in Starr County's COVID-19 cases.
We definitely noticed where very significant in the increase of number of cases. All of these family reunions, barbecues outside, pool parties.
With only 1 hospital in the county and fewer than 2 doctors for every 10,000 people, the healthcare system in Starr was overwhelmed. At one point in July, the county's top official announced on Facebook that doctors are going to have to decide who receives treatment and who is sent home to die. Vasquez says that is not happening. State and federal governments have stepped in. The Navy sent 2 medical teams to help. The Veterans Hospital in San Antonio, the second largest city in Texas, is also accepting patients from Starr County. More than 20 people in the county have died of COVID-19, but actual numbers are higher, says Vasquez, because of paperwork delays.
Now, unfortunately, we are seeing multiple fatalities within families itself.
Further taxing Starr County Memorial Hospital is the arrival of COVID-19 patients from Mexico.
For us, every patient counts the same. For us, every patient's life has the same value than the others.
It's been a ride. It's a very overwhelming.
Gonzalez will do her part in helping comfort those who are grieving for their lost loved ones. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
Greece has recorded its biggest spike in COVID-19 infections since emerging from a nationwide lockdown 3 months ago. The country's virus-free status relative to others in Europe has largely faded since allowing tourists to visit again. But now authorities are largely blaming young Greeks for the dramatic rise in infections, accusing them of socializing recklessly and not acting responsibly. Anthony Karasava reports on the surging health crisis and how officials fear here, Greece is just weeks away from living a nightmarish contagion, much like that already seen in Italy earlier this year.
For a country that had until recently only about 3,000 COVID-19 infections, Tuesday's single count of 121 new cases set off alarm bells. It also forced Sotiris Tsiodras, an infectious diseases expert and the head of the Greek government's medical response team, to return to the public podium, issuing a stark warning 70 days after Greece claimed it had successfully flattened its coronavirus curve. The situation now, he says, is dangerous, and Greeks have to understand the severity of it because the fate of this flare-up ultimately hinges upon them. If people behave as they should, Mr. Tsiodras says, then they can once again quash the curve. But if they do not, then this can easily and quickly turn into what he described as an Italian-like calamity. COVID-19 infections have been climbing since tourists began trickling back into the sun-drenched country in early June. But as Greeks too have started seeking summer retreat, they also have been loosening up in their compliance with social distancing rules, refusing to wear masks at beach bars, restaurants, and social gatherings. Homegrown cases have overtaken foreign ones. State statistics released Wednesday suggested only 10% of Greece's COVID-19 cases are linked to tourism. To stem the spread, authorities have introduced a new list of measures, including a cap on large weddings and celebrations that officials say have contributed to the dramatic rise in COVID-19 cases here. They have also implemented tighter border controls, mainly from Albania, where the pandemic shows no signs of abating. But reining in Greece's beach-partying youth is proving more difficult. Greek Civil Protection Minister Nikos Kardalias is now calling on people in their 20s, 30s and 40s to socialize responsibly, not recklessly. He says that as a father, he appeals to the youth to step up to the plate and to take the lead in protecting Greece and what it has managed to achieve in these past few months in keeping itself clear of the virus. The youth, he says, should now act as young heroes, protecting their families, parents, and grandparents. But to officials, it appears that young people are not doing that. Islands like Mykonos and Ios are buzzing with beach parties, defying stiff regulations and steep fines for those failing to observe rules that require them to remain seated at bars, open-air nightclubs and concerts. It is no wonder, health experts say, that the average age of cases here has now dropped from 72 to 52, with the slide slipping more and more into younger age groups traveling around the country during summer break. Charalla Bozgogos is a doctor advising the state government's response. He explains that the alarming element in this flare-up is the speed with which it is spreading. It has doubled, he says, in just a matter of days. Any further rise from this point on, he warns, will spell an unchecked pandemic. He says it's imperative to keep the rate and pace of the infections down. With Greece's economy largely dependent on tourism, government officials say they do not want to resort to a new nationwide lockdown, fearing it could scare travelers and business away. Antti Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
Due to concerns about the spread of the coronavirus, a growing number of U.S. states plan to hold the November presidential election by mail rather than in-person voting. President Donald Trump has repeatedly claimed mail-in voting will lead to election fraud. White House correspondent Patsy Witakuswara looks at how mail-in voting could delay election results and sow doubt about the outcome.
Some New Yorkers braved the threat of coronavirus and voted in person in the June Democratic primary. But many voted by mail, flooding an unprepared election system. 6 weeks later, election results in some districts still haven't been called. President Donald Trump has repeatedly warned that if states rely on mail-in balloting for the November presidential poll, the same kind of delays could take place.
You won't know the election result for weeks, months, maybe years after. Maybe you'll never know the election result, and that's what I'm concerned with. It'll be fixed, it'll be rigged.
Election officials say voter fraud in the U.S. is extremely rare, even when it comes to mail-in voting. Most states allow voting by mail, but this year many expect they will need extra time to count the large number of ballots during the pandemic. It wouldn't be the first time U.S. election results are delayed. The controversial decision on the 2000 race between Al Gore and George W. Bush was delayed for more than a month because of recounts in Florida. The upcoming November poll could be even more controversial. Matthew Weil is the director of the Election Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
We're in a hyper-polarized environment right now, and so any window where a candidate can claim that there's some sort of chicanery happening behind the scenes is a problem. The big problem this time is it's not just going to be one state. It's not going to be one Florida. I think that there are a good three or four, maybe five states where it could take that week.
While Trump has walked back his suggestion that the election should be delayed, he has continued to raise doubts and suspicion about mail-in voting. Richard Hazen is an election law professor at the University of California, Irvine.
If more of his supporters vote in person, and he's ahead on election night, he could claim, as he's already suggested, that the mail-in ballots that are coming in are fraudulent and try and claim victory.
On Wednesday, Trump's campaign sued the state of Nevada, led by Democrats, over a plan to send mail-in ballots to all registered voters. But in the battleground state of Florida, led by Republicans, the president is encouraging voting by mail, saying its current and past governors cleaned up the state's election system, making it safe and secure.
The two governors, between the both of them, they've really got a great system of absentee ballots and even in the case of mail-in ballots.
Polls show more Americans want to vote by mail in November, but there's a growing divide about whether it's truly secure. Carlin Bowman is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
Democrats are much more likely than Republicans to say right now that they'd like to vote by mail.
Expanding the pool of voters participating in some states will help Biden. In others, such as Florida, it's expected to benefit Trump. Whoever wins, election analysts say the main challenge will be ensuring both parties see the result as credible. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Democrat Joe Biden will not be on hand when Democrats formally make him their presidential nominee later this summer, thanks to concerns over safety in the middle of the pandemic. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The convention in Milwaukee will be almost entirely virtual, and a Democrat with knowledge of the decision says Biden will not be there to accept the nomination because of coronavirus concerns. It's the latest blow to the traditional nominating conventions.
But the virus is also upending the Republican gathering. President Trump has canceled his acceptance speech in Florida, but Wednesday suggested a location that would be another break with presidential custom.
The president says he'll probably deliver the speech from the White House.
It's easy, and I think it's a beautiful setting.
Telling Fox and Friends it's certainly one of the alternatives, but it would be an unprecedented move, using public property for partisan political purposes. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi tells MSNBC he can't do that. And top Republican Senators John Thune and John Cornyn both use the word problematic, with Cornyn saying he'd need somebody to show him where it says the president could give the speech from the White House.
AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani. Cameroon says separatists fighting to create an English-speaking state in the French-majority nation have resorted to planting landmines. The warning came when a landmine exploded in the northwestern town of Bamenda, killing six people and wounding nine. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Valen Carr, commander of the forces fighting separatists in the northwest region, says fighters have planted landmines in several towns and villages. The army general says several military vehicles have been destroyed and that the devices have left people dead or wounded. He says troops are out to detect and destroy the mines. He says the military needs the cooperation of civilians to protect people from being killed or wounded. He says separatist fighters who fail to drop their weapons and stop planting landmines will be killed because Cameroon is a state of law and cannot tolerate illegality. Nkar did not give the number of troops and civilians who are among the casualties. He also did not comment on the number of vehicles destroyed, but said the mines were numerous. He said the northwestern towns of Kumbu, Oku, Ndop, Wum, Bafut, Bamenda, Mbengwi, and Jakiri had witnessed an increase in the planting of mines by fighters. The separatists have been fighting to establish a state they call Ambazonia since 2016. Last Tuesday, a landmine exploded in Bamenda, killing 6 people and wounding 9 others. Christopher Fauvert, a 32-year-old elementary school teacher, says God saved his life from the blast. He says the mine, known locally as Manyi, exploded when the transport car in which he was riding drove across it. He spoke via a messaging app from Bamenda.
When the smoke gradually disappeared, we discovered that the car we were inside got shattered. People were wounded, some died. I was lucky to be among those who survived. Manyi is very dangerous. We saw iron rods that wounded people, that killed people. That is what they use in fabricating this manyi.
The military said fighters are disguising themselves as civilians and planting landmines on roads used regularly by troops and in towns and villages that oppose separatist activities. It says some are planted around military bases. Deben Chofo, governor of Cameroon's northwest region, says the separatists are resorting to landmines because their firepower has been drastically reduced by the military. Chofo says civilians have also contributed greatly to weaken the separatists.
People finally have discovered that they were misled. They were deceived. They have decided to rise against those dream sellers. They have done a very good job by organizing themselves into vigilante groups. They're rising against the separatists.
The separatists have said on social media that they will use all tactics to defeat and eject government forces from their territory. They reject the idea their firepower has declined and say they are out to protect civilians from military abuses. The separatists also accuse the military of planting the landmines in order to give the separatists a bad name. The military reports that it successfully detonated 32 mines within a 2-week period and is asking civilians not to try to detonate explosives they may find. The military is also asking the population to be careful and report any suspicious persons in their communities. According to the United Nations, the 4-year separatist crisis in the English-speaking Western regions has left at least 3,000 people dead and displaced 500,000 from their homes. Moki Edwin Kinzaka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. It's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And to AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. Facebook's Instagram is officially launching its answer to the hit short video app TikTok. It's called Instagram Reels. The new Instagram feature will let users record and edit 15-second videos with audio and will let users add visual effects. Users will also be able to share Reels with followers on Instagram in a dedicated section called Reels and Explore. The Reels option will be available in the Instagram app. And Lady Gaga is teaming up with Apple Music for a weekly show called Gaga Radio, where she'll chat with some of the leading lights of dance music and debut exclusive DJ mixes starting this Friday. Excerpts released in advance of Friday's debut have Gaga describing the making of her recent album in emotional and dramatic terms. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.